This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Jean Marie Peacock, who is one of the pastors of Lakeview Presbyterian Church in New Orleans, one of the first neighborhoods to be inundated by floodwaters after Hurricane Katrina. Basically wiped out your church. Is that accurate, Jean Marie? How would you describe what happened to the building?
Well, our church building was flooded up to 7 feet on the first floor of the building, so it's destroyed everything in the sanctuary, in the offices, library, kitchen, fellowship hall. And in addition, most of our members live in the community that was filled with water, so at least 2/3 of a membership of our church have lost their homes, or their homes have been damaged heavily.
And your home, did you live in that neighborhood too?
Not in that neighborhood, but our neighborhood was also flooded, and our house had 7 feet of water as well. So It's been destroyed as well. It'll have to be demolished, and all the belongings inside as well have been destroyed.
Will the church building also have to be demolished, or is it salvageable?
It is salvageable. We'll be gutting out the whole interior, cleaning it out, and then rebuilding the interior. We also have a day school that served 90 children, a preschool, as part of our church ministry in a separate building, and it flooded to the ceilings. And that building will have to be demolished and we'll have to rebuild.
Now, how did you get to New Orleans? You don't sound like you have a Louisiana accent.
No, I finished seminary at Louisville Seminary. My husband and I were there, and he was offered a job working with a small company in New Orleans, which took us to New Orleans about 3.5 years ago. So we've been there that long and had just recently purchased a home and had moved into the neighborhood where we were living in the last 2 years.
Mm. Now, you say the church building, Lakeview Presbyterian Church, was one of the first neighborhoods to be inundated by water. How did that happen?
Well, that was caused by the breach in the 17th Street Canal following the hurricane when we had thought at that point in time that everything was going to be fine. And it was Tuesday morning that we woke up and heard the news of the breach in two canals. It turns out there are other breaches as well. The London Avenue Canal breach is the breach that filled our neighborhood where we live with water.
Now, had you left New Orleans when the warnings were given that the hurricane was coming and it was going to be bad?
Yes. We began boarding up our home on Saturday, and we left early, 2 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning. Our congregation, we called through our phone system, electronic phone system, all the members of our church on Saturday and told them that we were going to be canceling worship on Sunday and encouraged people to evacuate. And then my husband and I left the city 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and we drove to first Jackson, Mississippi, and then on to Memphis, Tennessee. And when we heard about the break in the levee, we knew it would be quite a while before we could even go back. So we came on to Champaign-Urbana, which is where my parents live and where I grew up, and spent a month here before we returned to New Orleans.
I want to ask you, of course, about what you found when you returned. But before we get to that, how many of the people in your congregation did follow the encouragement to leave the city? Or were there some who stayed on and did you lose any people in the hurricane or the flood?
Yes, we did. We lost 2 people. One was a gentleman who stayed in his home and did not evacuate. The other was a man who was in one of the hospitals, and in the evacuation from the hospital, given the conditions of the evacuation, the lack of power for life support, he died in the process of that evacuation from the hospital.
Mm. Now, how big of a congregation is there at the church you serve?
We have 335 members. And many of them evacuated, and many are still spread out around the country in the places where they evacuated too. We have families with children who have enrolled their children in the schools where they evacuated.
Sure.
And will not be returning to the area until schools open in the New Orleans area.
Hmm. Now, what was the culture like? Were there people in your congregation who just felt, well, we've weathered all these other hurricanes. They always say it's going to be bad. It's never as bad as people think. Was that attitude prevalent?
I think there was some of that attitude. But the reporting that was coming through the news channels and the weather channels in relationship to this hurricane as a Category 5 that was headed directly to New Orleans gave a sense that it was a dire situation and that it was very important for people to begin evacuation.
Now, in your 3.5 years in New Orleans, had you encountered other hurricanes, other lesser hurricanes?
Yes. The first year we lived there, there were two. There was actually a hurricane and a tropical storm within a week of each other that created quite a bit of flooding in the city and some damage. And then Tropical Storm Cindy, just about a month before Katrina, caused quite a bit of damage, tree damage falling throughout the city and power loss. And then more recently, my husband and I last year evacuated for Hurricane Ivan, as many people through the city had done. It was during the evacuation for Hurricane Ivan that the city became very aware of flaws in evacuation plans when the traffic was such gridlock that traffic didn't move for hours as people were parked, in a sense, on the interstates.
Did that happen to you?
We evacuated later after some of that gridlock had broken up. But they changed some of their plans then, which I think were helpful for Hurricane Katrina in the contraflows that they created for traffic patterns.
Now, when you left early in the morning, you said it was early Sunday morning you actually left?
Yes,
What was the traffic like then?
It was flowing pretty well. The mandatory evacuation out of the city had not occurred yet. So and most people head west toward Baton Rouge and into Texas, and we headed north into Mississippi, and the traffic flow north was much better.
Why did you make that choice?
We knew that ultimately, if we needed to, we could go all the way to Illinois.
Well, you might get hit with a tornado, but at least not hurricane. Let's talk a little bit about this theologically. Your training as a pastor, you'd been in Louisville Seminary. What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 2000.
So you went right to New Orleans. That was your first?
Well, it was my first call, and I was ordained to a small church in Louisville, which I served while I was finishing seminary and then after I completed seminary. But it was soon after that we went to New Orleans.
And explain to listeners who may be from other religious traditions or from with no religious training, what a call is.
A call is an understanding of how a person is being called by God into a particular type of ministry. And call comes in a variety of different ways, but is heard in the Presbyterian denomination, we understand it to be heard both a direct direct call from God, but it also is affirmed in community and by the congregation and by the larger church community. So I was called into ministry. My call, I felt, came a lot through my interactions with people in the mission field when I was working as a missionary for quite a few years for the Presbyterian Church.
Where was that?
I worked on the U.S.-Mexican border with refugees from Central America.
What years?
Mid-1980s until early 1990s.
What kind of an organization?
I worked with what was known as the Sanctuary Movement at the time, which was an effort of churches all around the country who were providing safe haven to refugees from Central America who were being deported by U.S. immigration back to the torture and violence that they were fleeing. And as congregations, we were providing protection of life as we assisted them with safe crossing into the United States and housing and transportation and helping them to get settled either here or applying for political asylum to Canada.
And what occasioned this relatively small church, 330 members, to call you as pastor with that kind of a background? Because my guess is that that was a fairly radical idea to this congregation in New Orleans, or was it?
The congregation in New Orleans is a real diverse group of people as far as where they fall theologically and their understandings of different issues theologically. I was called primarily because I also have an intense passion for church transformation and for working with congregations and outreach into communities, into neighborhoods in ways that revitalize the life and ministry of that church, working particularly with younger generations, which many churches find hard to attract these days. And I think that was that passion, my passion for, I have a passion for social justice, a real sense of Christ's call to be in ministry and mission in the world and how we reach out and share the gospel in vital ways that bring the gospel alive to people.
So did you think you'd be called to a ministry of dealing with people who are suffering from a hurricane?
I never imagined that that would be the case.
So let's talk a little bit about what you found. You left, the hurricane came. When did you first hear about what really happened to the church building or your home?
That took some time. It was after we arrived in Champaign-Urbana. Several days later, we spent quite a bit of time watching the news, listening to see what neighborhoods were impacted. We heard pretty early on that Lakeview was impacted when the 17th Street area broke. Our own neighborhood we didn't learn about until later when we were surfing websites and finding overhead pictures of neighborhoods and figured out where our house was located and could see that our home was surrounded, the whole neighborhood was filled with water.
Hmm. And when did you hear about the losses of the people in your congregation?
Much, much later. Hmm. With the flooding, it was very difficult to have access into the area and also to gain information, and communication was very difficult. We still have not located 40 members of our church.
Really?
And early on, cell phones were not working that had a 504 area code. Mm-hmm. So with the church directory that I had, I couldn't call people's cell phone numbers knowing they had evacuated. So we relied heavily on email and the internet initially to try to communicate and locate members of our church. Many of the older folks in our congregation don't have internet access. The man who died in his home, we did not find out until I went on the web and finally did a search for his name, found a bulletin board, one of those public bulletin boards of people trying to locate loved ones. His daughter had posted on the bulletin board that they were trying to locate him, and that was her contact information. I then contacted her with that information, and she informed me that they had just recently discovered his body.
I see. Now, what did you say to her as a pastor?
Well, expressed our real deep sense of grief in his loss. He was such a kind and gentle and wonderful man. I shared with her my sense of thanksgiving for his life and the many ways that he had been a part of the life of our church and the different ways that he contributed. He was a woodworker. He did a lot of projects for the church, for our vacation Bible school. He would construct a boat if we were talking about Noah's Ark, or if we were dealing with the theme around light, he would build a large lighthouse for the children to use around vacation Bible school and other kinds of things like that. A very giving man. So I shared with her the sense of a real gift of his life and thanksgiving for his life, as well as our sense of sorrow and grief in losing him.
Now, often, soon after disasters, natural or human caused, people often have very glib responses as to religious people, Christian people often have glib responses to the suffering and why it happened and so on. But when you've gone through it yourself and have lost friends and all your worldly possessions, how do you deal with it in terms of your faith? Do you say, I mean, where is God when there's this kind of thing happening?
You look for signs of God's presence and the experiences of God's presence in the midst of the loss and the grief and the devastation. And we felt God's presence made manifest in the offers of assistance and the love and expressions of care and support that have come from all over the country and all over the world in response to what has happened, and the kinds of volunteers and others who have come down into the area to help. That manifestation of love and care and compassion in the midst of it. And also, for my husband and I, when we went first into our house, we had on our kitchen wall a needlepoint that had been given to us. And even though our kitchen was just demolished and everything strewed on the floors and rusted and ruined and the walls covered with mold, this white needlepoint was pristine and still hanging. And on what it says is, God bless this home. And there was this real sense that reminder that home isn't the material thing, and home isn't the actual church building, that it's not the physical, but it's what we make of our home as our relationships with each other. And our home is in God's embrace, and our home is who we are together. And it was a reminder of that in the midst of all of this and the material loss and all of that. That these are just buildings and they're things. It's easy, you can say that, but I mean, things have sentimental value, but still they're just things, and there's things that are more important in life than the material things that we surround ourselves with.
When you went on this evacuation, you'd evacuated once before, and your home wasn't destroyed, but this time, you'd done it once before. What did you take with you? You mentioned you took your church directory. What else did you take?
We both packed suitcases that had some clothing in them. I have a carry-on bag that I use when I travel in my role as vice moderator for the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, and it's always packed with some of the basic things I carry with me. So included in that was the stole. The vice moderator's stole for the denomination.
Tell people what a stole is.
A stole is what is worn along with a robe in celebrating in worship. It's a strip of cloth that goes that you wear around your neck and is a symbol of the office. And we also took with us some photographs. We had wedding pictures that we took with us. And for my husband's work, we stopped by his laboratory in downtown New Orleans as we were evacuating, and he took with him some serum that's very important to their research and their test trials on fibromyalgia, and we carried that in a cooler on ice with us as we came and evacuated.
Did it travel safely?
It did travel safely. Mm. It ended up being in a laboratory, being kept here in a laboratory at the University of Illinois, and refrigerated.
Mm. Minus 80, probably. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Jean Marie Peacock, one of the pastors of Lakeview Presbyterian Church in New Orleans, which was heavily damaged by the hurricane and the flooding afterwards, who also lost her home, where she and her husband. How long had you had the home?
2 years.
2 years. This is a live program every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 here on AM 580, WILL AM. And if listeners would like to ask a question or make a comment, please do call us. Anywhere the program is heard, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, and that includes listeners on the Internet. Maybe there's some even in New Orleans listening through their computer to this live program. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can call us using a local line that'll connect to two or three lines here in the studio. Punch in 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-WILL. Jean-Marie, you went to seminary after you'd been a missionary?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
It seems a bit backwards.
I actually never imagined myself going into the ministry, and it was, I did feel very called to work with those who are suffering and feel that my call was to those on the margins. And so my experience with refugees from Central America and those years of working with the church in Mexico and with church leaders throughout Central America was a beginning of a continued call that I've experienced now in ministry. I feel like I was called to ministry when I was in mission work.
Mm-hmm.
It was not ordained to the ministry of word and sacrament, but
and
it was ministry.
You didn't feel it was necessary to go to seminary to do that.
No, I didn't.
Right. Uh-huh. But you felt called to do that.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. It was a call that I couldn't explain at the time.
How old were you when you started that?
I was in my early 20s. It was a year after college.
Where had you been in college?
I went to the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. And right out of college, I went to work in Washington, D.C., and worked with a group home for severely mentally retarded women and physically disabled women. And during that time, also volunteered in a homeless shelter for the year, many nights. And from there, went and worked as a mission worker at a global mission conference center of the Presbyterian Church, which is where I met many refugees from Central America and began to build relationships in Stony Point, New York.
Stony Point. We have a caller waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Jean Marie Peacock. Go ahead, please.
I'd be interested in your impression and understanding of what various groups of people, maybe by poverty level or educational level or where they live in the city, have of the environmental problems of the New Orleans areas, of the loss of wetland habitats and the loss of barrier islands. Do people understand that some of the problems they have come from destroying those areas? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you. I think people do understand that the part of the problem has been the loss of the wetlands over the years, and that legislatively, over time, there's been reduced funding for the protection of the wetlands and for the whole area around New Orleans and the environmental situation. In terms of the different groups of people who've been impacted, clearly I think we saw on television and in the reporting and the reality of that always it's the poorest of the poor who are left behind in our society, in our cities, and even in our world, I think, in the midst of a global economy. The city of New Orleans is based much on a tourist industry that's focused on hospitality, and a large number of people work for minimum wage jobs in hotels and restaurants, which are not living wages. So those who are left behind at the Superdome and at the convention center did not have the resources to evacuate. They didn't have the money for gas, or they did not own a vehicle and have a way to leave. So I think and I hope that we as a nation will open our eyes to some of the realities of how the kind of social policy issues that this has raised and the need for us to continue to work for living wage. I would advocate increasing a minimum wage. And I would also hope that we would invest resources that we have as a nation into the infrastructures of cities, into educational systems. The educational system in New Orleans is a bankrupt system that has been defunct for many, many years. And we need to be investing in infrastructure of cities, of schools, and into the environment and into parks and programs that support the livelihood and the benefit and the welfare of all of the people within the city. And it's my hope that we'll learn lessons from this, both environmental lessons, the ways that we invest our resources as a nation.
Jean Marie, when the order came to evacuate New Orleans, did the city, county, state, federal government provide any means to get out for people who didn't have means themselves?
No, the evacuation plan had been that people who could not evacuate would go to the Superdome. And there was transportation provided to the Superdome through public transportation. There were stations where they announced that people could go to be picked up by public transportation to go to the Superdome.
What's your reaction to the lack of federal help very quickly?
Well, I think it was a real travesty of it was... I think that our nation hadn't seen a disaster of this scope caused by a hurricane ever in its history and was ill-prepared on all levels. We were ill-prepared on the city level, on the state level, and on a national level. And the federal response, I think there was some ineptitude on the part of government officials and not fully understanding the scope of the situation.
And in terms of religious response after the crisis happened, what have you seen?
Well, there's been a response in providing assistance to folks all throughout the region. Churches that have opened and become shelters for those who evacuated. Work teams that have been coming in and volunteering to help with cleanup and mucking out homes and other types of things. And that's very, very apparent. There's also some organizing among churches to begin to address some of the bigger picture concerns around levee systems and around the rebuilding of the city and questions about how the city is rebuilt in a way that really reflects the diversity and the broad culture of the community. I had a chance to meet with representatives from the National Council of Churches who came into the area to meet with church leaders, and we talked about the need to bring together various judicatory bodies of various denominations and faith groups to meet together and to develop a vision and a plan to share with the mayor and with the city, but also to advocate together with legislators and folks in federal government.
Are there any religious leaders who are part of the official task force set up by the mayor?
I actually am not sure.
Now, what is the religious makeup of New Orleans? We know, of course, it's heavily Catholic, but I don't know to what extent.
It is a largely Roman Catholic community. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but it's certainly the majority of the population.
Uh-huh. And yet now, the majority of the population of New Orleans city itself is African American.
Yes.
Are the majority of them Catholic?
I really don't know the demographics.
That would be interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. Traditionally, black churches, I know, have had to. Have had national responses to the African American folks in the New Orleans area, because I know local congregations that have sent buses and taken supplies and tried to help very quickly. So I know that's one of the things that went on, and I know. Here at this university, a number of students who got kicked out of, couldn't go back to Tulane and other places have ended up here, as well as many other universities around the country. And many of the universities are providing an education without tuition payments and so forth. So I commend the University of Illinois administration for responding in that way to the need of students.
Yes.
We're about halfway through our program. We're talking with Jean Marie Peacock, who is Associate Pastor of Lakeview Presbyterian Church in New Orleans, which was heavily damaged by the flooding after the Hurricane Katrina, and her and her husband's home was effectively destroyed, or will need to be torn down because of water damage as well. We'll be talking with her for the second half of the program about those experiences, as well as her experience as vice moderator of the Presbyterian Church of the United States of America, and what she's learned in her time so far of her 2-year term traveling around the country, talking to different parts of that particular brand of the Christian Church, one of the Protestant denominations. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here on AM 580 WILL every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6. Next week, we'll be talking about one of the issues Jean Marie is concerned about, which is affordable housing. We'll be talking with Eugene Barnes of the Metanoia Project, part of the Central Illinois Organizing Project. On the week following, November 20, we'll be talking about the Peace Bazaar that's sponsored by several different congregations in the Champaign-Urbana community. On November 27th, we'll be talking about the Secret Gospel of Mark with a professor who's a bit skeptical of this. Stephen Carlson will be our guest, who's the author of The Gospel Hoax, The Secret Gospel of Mark. And then Larry Lieberman in December, Father George Pyle from the Greek Orthodox Church. And so we'll have several interesting programs ahead. Hope you can tune in. If not, you can always listen to them when they're archived at WILL.UIUC.edu. And you can go then to Keeping the Faith and check for a program you missed or to hear part of a program you only heard a little bit of. And they're there in practically forever. So do enjoy those on your computer if you have that facility. These Keeping the Faith programs are supported in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois, where I am the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois. It was founded by students in 1873. Yes, that's 1873, just 6 years after the university began. And since that time, the Y has been helping students develop their leadership abilities by being engaged in social action, in community service, in volunteering to tutor or volunteering to work on environmental issues or issues of human trafficking, Amnesty International, a lot of very important organizations come out of the University YMCA, and I've been happy to be the director there for the last 6.5 years. One of the programs of the Y is Communiversity. We have classes that will start up again next January. And people, we're looking now for instructors for those community classes. We need to get your applications to teach a class by December 30. And we offer a huge variety of classes to the community, from ballroom dancing to car repair to martial arts to all sorts of things, and book studies, photography. But we rely upon local community members to design the course and teach the courses. Some instructors have worked with us for 15 or 20 years, but we're always interested in new and exciting class topics that other people might develop. So if you're interested, please check out our website, universityymca.org/communiversity, or if you want to make a phone call, 337-1514, and ask for Paul or Becca at the University Y if you'd like to teach a class. Coming up this Friday on Friday Forum, we're through with our Tuesday lectures for this semester, but we have one last lecture in Friday Forum. And ordinarily, I can speak highly of our speakers, but this week, I'm sorry to say that I've been invited to speak myself, so I can't really recommend it. But what I'm going to be trying to talk about is our visions of conscience as seen in contemporary fiction. Contemporary defined the last 100 years or so. And the theme for Friday Forum this whole semester has been conscience in action. And so I'll be looking at a Marilyn Robinson novel and maybe go back to even P.G. Wodehouse. So that's Friday at noon at the Y. Like I say, I can't really recommend me, but I'll be doing my best. That's at noon. If you'd like to make reservations for lunch, call the Y, 337-1500, or just show up and enjoy the Thai food or bring your own lunch or simply listen to the lecture. Well, let's get back to our guest, Jean Marie Peacock, and we have a caller on line one who's been very patient while I gave the little ad for the Y. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
I know her mom and her dad, and also I think this is a major disaster, and this is a program about keeping the faith. This is a perfect example of faith and works. Who takes care of you, Jean Marie? I know you're in much demand. Who takes care of you? And I'll hang up and listen to your response off the air.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you. I think for me, the care has come from the broader church, both through our presbytery. In the Presbyterian Church, we have different governing bodies, and the Presbytery of South Louisiana, which covers the whole region of South Louisiana, there's been a great sense among clergy of working together and being supportive of each other in the midst of all of this. So much of that support and care has come from colleagues and from people of faith as well, from various parts of the country who've expressed their care and their concern.
Now, when you first learned of your personal losses of property and the church damage to the church, you were here in Illinois. How soon were you able to get back and actually see things yourself?
They didn't open up our zip code area for us to be able to return officially into the city until, I think it was the 4th of October. And we returned, or it might have been the 5th of October, it was early October. We returned to the area a day or two before then. And when we first went to our house, I really didn't have a sense of the kind of destruction that could be done when water is inside a home for the period of time that we had water inside of our house. I had thought maybe the water would just gradually, you know, rises and then it gradually comes down and things would still be in their place. And so what surprised me is the way that nothing in our house and most things in our church were not left standing and not in place where they had been. There's not, I don't think, one pew in our entire sanctuary that is still left standing.
And they were probably screwed to the floor.
And a piano that had been on the floor of the sanctuary that had been pushed by the water and moved and floated up several steps to be turned over was on its side behind the lectern. We had pieces of furniture that had been by the sanctuary that had floated down hallways and we found in totally different opposite sides of the church building.
So when a levee breaks, the water really just rushes through places.
It seems like the water had some force. And in our house as well, you know, a nightstand we had next to our bed had gone all the way from one end of the house to the other and was in the laundry room behind the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And the furniture basically rots and disintegrates and is covered with mold. It falls apart as you try to lift it. So that kind of destruction where so much is left as rubble and covered with mud and gunk and it's hard to imagine unless you can actually be there and see it.
What was your impression when you first did you drive into the city or did you fly down and then?
We drove into the city and we drove into our neighborhood, my impression was just how much destruction there had been. There was nothing much green at that point in time. No green grass and any bushes and shrubs and anything that had been underwater had died as well.
Sure. What about the trees?
And trees. The tops of trees still green, but many trees had fallen, and there were boats, you know, that had just been left stranded in various places, and just debris everywhere, and you could see some destruction to buildings as we were driving in as well. The neighborhood still feels like a ghost town because the houses are uninhabitable, so it's very, very quiet. And there's not much movement, and it's very still.
And how does this affect you emotionally and spiritually? I mean, the stuff of this world is what we count on. I mean, we count on being able to turn that corner and see that house or drive by that tree or pick up this book, and now that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Can you sleep at night?
Initially, I was having problems sleeping at night. That's changed with time. I think part of it is the process of coming to accept the realities of the loss. And that's been a gradual process of letting go. And I think for me, this has been, the entire experience has been an exercise in letting go, not just letting go of material things, but also letting go of believing that I like to be a person who plans things in advance and I have experience as a community organizer and administrator, and I do a lot of planning and think strategically about things. And for once in my life, I'm living with more questions than answers, and am waiting for other people and federal government and others to make decisions that impact our lives related to levee systems, related to building codes for rebuilding. There's a lot of talk about new building codes that will require houses to be raised as they're rebuilt. We're waiting for a variety of information.
Raised, R-A-I-S.
R-A-I-S-E-D. But we're also waiting on information about the demolition of homes and how that will take place. So we don't have much of a sense of control over all of these things, from housing to rebuilding, to being able to plan that much for the future at this point, besides looking for an apartment and beginning to find ways to furnish that and to get settled again in some way.
Do you have a job? Do you have a salary?
I do. With the congregation that I serve, again, talking about the support of the Presbyterian and the larger church, we have in the Presbyterian Church a organization called Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, and funds that have been raised through Presbyterian Disaster Assistance are providing financial support for the salaries of church staff, at least through the end of December, and there's hope that that can continue on into next year.
Because ordinarily your salary is paid by the congregation you serve, and those people are without work and without salaries, many of them, and many still haven't been found. They're scattered.
That's correct. My husband's work situation was heavily impacted as well by the flooding. Even though his laboratory and office were located on the 14th floor of a building downtown in New Orleans, it flooded slightly on through the first floor, and the management contacted all of the tenants and invited them to come for a day and to visit their office space. And when we arrived, we were given termination of lease notices, which they were giving to all the tenants in the building. So their business currently is looking for a new space where they can rebuild and build laboratory space and begin again.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And space is at a premium because there's so little that was not flooded. And that's true for housing as well. Rents have skyrocketed, more than doubled since Katrina, and that has had a major impact on the ability of people to come back and to work in the region.
Is that gouging, or is that just supply-demand capitalist economics?
Well, there's a lot
doubling,
of that.
Doubling the rent because so many people want to rent.
There's a lot of accusations of gouging, and it's my feeling that people are taking advantage of the situation.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the moral, what can we learn in terms of ethics and morality from some of your experiences with this particular disaster? You've had comments to make about people in government positions who were ill-prepared. You've talked about people who have sort of given help sacrificially, it sounds like, in some cases, to others. Any other lessons you've learned in this whole process?
Well, I think you see in the midst of a disaster both the best and the worst of people. Mm-hmm. And you never quite know how people are going to respond, both psychologically to the stresses that exist and physically and emotionally, but also, are people going to respond in a way that's ethical and treating others with care and compassion, or working in ways that are going to be of more greater self-interest. And and I think you see with a lot of the price gouging and that type of thing, folks who are taking advantage of this the situation for material gain. But there are a lot of examples, and many that do not make the news as well, of real care and compassion. And
tell me two.
Two stories. Well, one came from a member of our church who worked with Entergy, and in the midst of all the news that we were hearing about looting and about some of the violence that was occurring in downtown area, he was sharing stories of a pharmacist who returned to the area and opened up the pharmacy and gave medications and prescriptions out at no charge to folks in the community who had stayed, as well as providing that for police and for firefighters, for first responders, and for others. I think that's one example. There's examples of people who gathered supplies and came into the city and distributed food and water when that was not happening, that when FEMA was not providing it, that citizens took it in their own hands to do that. In our church situation, we had one congregation that was not flooded in the Bayou region who turned their church into a distribution center and began to gather large amounts of contributions that they have been packing up and sending out and to various places around New Orleans and other areas where food and water and other kinds of resources are needed. So.
We're talking with a New Orleans pastor, Jean Marie Peacock, who grew up in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and about her experiences after Hurricane Katrina and the flooding in New Orleans. If you have a question or comment, do give us a call in Champaign-Urbana. There are several lines you may access by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, including on the Internet, if you're listening, you may call us toll-free anywhere in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-9455. So 1-800-222-WILL outside of Champaign-Urbana. Jean Marie, we talked a little bit about your work with the Sanctuary Movement, and before that you had gone to the College of Worcester. Now, how did a good Methodist girl like you growing up here and elsewhere as the daughter of a Methodist campus pastor end up going to a Presbyterian seminary and becoming Presbyterian?
Well, I ended up going to a Presbyterian college, and it was my choice of a college. When I went to visit, I had really enjoyed the campus and the program that they offered in independent study and some of those opportunities. So it was really through my campus, my experience and involvement in campus ministry at the College of Worcester that I became involved with the Presbyterian Church. I didn't join the Presbyterian Church until quite a few years later, after several years of working as a mission volunteer. And it was when I was in Tucson at Southside Presbyterian Church that I finally decided to actually join the church that I had been involved with in all of the work with Sanctuary and the kind of volunteer and mission efforts that I was involved with.
Tell listeners who may not know about Southside.
Southside Presbyterian Church is one of several congregations that were the first to declare themselves public sanctuary for refugees from Central America. And the declaration of sanctuary was seen by federal officials as an act, illegal act of providing housing to persons who were undocumented. Persons involved with offering sanctuary understood that they were not only protecting the lives of persons, but that they were following international law, such as the Geneva Conventions and even U.S. law, such as the Refugee Act of 1980, that provides protection for those who are persecuted for reasons of religion, reasons of political perspectives, and other areas.
But the government claimed that those people were in this country illegally and because of economic reasons, just to better themselves, to make more money.
Well, the stories of those that I heard and that I helped were completely different stories than just economic situation. They were people who had lost family and loved ones and who'd been in villages where large numbers of people had been massacred, who had stories of torture and actual scars, physical scars on their bodies of torture, who brought with them pictures of loved ones. There was one man I remember in particular who brought a picture of his daughter after she had been stabbed over 20 times and her mutilated body. They had killed her when they had gone looking for him, and when they did not find him, they killed her as a warning to him. So there were many who did come with real physical evidence that they were persecuted and that they were fearing for their lives. And at the time, our government was not recognizing refugees from Central America as fleeing for out of persecution. And other countries such as Canada were and were providing political asylum. And part of our effort was what we would call civil initiative, but civilians taking the initiative to protect life when our government fails to do so.
Were you personally given any trouble by the government because of your involvement in the sanctuary movement during those years in the 80s?
I was not. Colleagues were arrested and indicted and faced possibilities of imprisonment. Some of the activities that we were involved with in helping refugees come into the United States safely or in transporting or providing housing carried with them up to 5 years imprisonment per action. And colleagues such as the pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church, John Fife, was among those who were indicted and were tried and found guilty and placed on probation.
I remember when John Fife came to Champaign-Urbana, where we also had a sanctuary movement of five congregations that were participating in providing that kind of sanctuary. And John Fife came in at one point when he was under indictment to speak about why he felt it was a Christian thing to do, an appropriate thing to do. Mm-hmm. It was quite a moving service. We're talking with Jean Marie Peacock from New Orleans. Now, why would you go back to New Orleans after this experience? You're vice moderator of the Presbyterian denomination. You're well known throughout the country. Many other churches would welcome you as to provide pastoral leadership. Why go back to New Orleans where this might happen again?
Well, immediately I wanted to be in New Orleans and involved in ministry with members of our congregation and the community, as we're involved both with working through the losses that we've experienced, but also as we move forward and rebuild. To me, it would feel like abandoning people in the midst of a real terrible situation. And I feel that as people of faith, we're called into places where there's going to be struggle and challenges that lie ahead, but to be engaged in ministry and support and showing love and compassion in the midst of it all is, and providing some vision for where we move to and the future that God has in store for us.
You've talked about learning to deal with loss and trying to become less attached to things. But what do you regret losing the most? What two or three things come to mind?
I really actually hadn't thought much about that. I think that one thing that was hard for us was some furniture that had been in Peter's family that had belonged to his grandparents and great-grandparents. And so that was difficult. And for me, I think part of what's hard as well is the loss of some things from my childhood, some papers I had from school or stuffed animals and things like that that I had kept that had some special meaning.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the tools of your trade? Pastors need to prepare sermons and things like that. Did you lose your library?
I lost my professional library, but those are things that can be replaced.
Mm-hmm. Not cheaply.
Not cheaply, no. But.
And what have you learned about insurance?
Well, we've learned a lot about flood insurance, which is a federally subsidized program where they only allow certain maximums on coverage for contents and for buildings. Mm. And so most everybody in New Orleans, even those who have flood insurance, are finding that what is provided as the maximum level of coverage does not cover even maybe a third of what the actual loss has been.
Mm. When have you actually moved back to New Orleans? You said you're searching for an apartment.
Yeah, we spent the last month living with friends across the lake, Lake Pontchartrain, in Mandeville, Louisiana, and recently found an apartment where we will plan to move in mid-November.
What are the challenges ahead for your congregation?
Well, we've started weekly worship already, joining with another congregation, and we worship together, and we'll do so for some time. I think the challenges that we face are some of the realities of many of our members not returning to the area. We don't really have a full sense yet of who that will be, but we have heard from people who have let us know that they have decided that they will not return. I think what's encouraging is that we do hear from people as well who are planning to return in January or at the end of the year when schools begin to reopen and housing, the hope is more housing will open up for those who want to come back into the area.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Jean Marie Peacock. Thank you, Jean, for spending this time on what I know is a busy day after you're preaching this morning to a very large gathering of Presbyterians from several different congregations at the Virginia Theater. Thank you for adding this radio conversation as well. Thanks also to our listeners, particularly those who called in with comments or questions. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the host for Keeping the Faith, usually. And I'm the director of the University YMCA. Jean Marie mentioned the importance of campus ministry in her life, and the University Y has been a campus ministry here at the University of Illinois for 132 years now. We survive by the support of people who care about the University Y and its programs and the help we provide for students. And if you'd like to make a contribution, check out our website or give us a call at 337-1500 to find out how. You may also donate a vehicle to the University Y. We sell those, and you get the deduct the value of that car, what we sell it for, from your taxes as a charitable contribution. If you'd like to do that, give me a call at the Y, 337-1500 during the week. Coming up next week we'll be talking about affordable housing in the Champaign-Urbana area with our guest, Eugene Barnes. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Chris Ayres never wanted to cover the war. He was perfectly content reporting on celebrity gossip in L.A. But through a twist of fate, he found himself embedded with Marines in Iraq, living in a Humvee and waiting for his death at the hands of the Republican Guard. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, a self-proclaimed coward covers the war. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy this evening, then clearing with the low around 40 degrees, and west winds around 10 miles per hour during the evening becoming light. Tomorrow, increasingly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight, the low in the lower 50s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.